Can I welcome everyone here to the first of the Lionel Robbins Memorial Lectures for this year. Lionel Robbins was one of the outstanding individuals of his time. Economist, public servant, and supporter of the arts. He was associated with the LSE for over 30 years, both as professor of economics and chairman of the Court of Governors. During the war, he was director of the economics section of the War Cabinet and was one of the designers of the Bretton Woods Agreement, which established the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. This fund, which was established in his memory, each year supports a postgraduate research scholarship as well as a series of three lectures given on successive days at the school by a distinguished economist or by a contributor to one of the main fields of economics, as is true of our speaker this evening, who is not primarily an economist but a psychologist. It gives me great pleasure to welcome to the school this year Lionel Robbins lecturer, Professor Daniel Kahneman. It has been said that economics is the most self-sufficient of all the social sciences. I mean, I've also said that sometimes, clearly bounded from the others, including psychology. Daniel Kahneman has given good cause, however, to question this view. He is probably the most eminent scholar who has attempted to connect economics and psychology in the current generation of researchers. His work has been particularly influential in a field in which I have a strong personal interest also, the study of risk, among many other areas in respect of choice, rationality, and preference. Professor Kahneman received his original degree in psychology and mathematics from the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He has taught at the Hebrew University and at a diversity of institutions in the United States. He is currently professor of psychology, Princeton University, and also professor of public affairs in the Woodrow Wilson School at the same university. It is a great honor to have Professor Kahneman here with us, and I'd like to welcome him personally to the LSE. He begins the series this evening with what I take it as a provocative title, Is Rationality Feasible? Professor Kahneman, welcome.
Very much. I'm very much honored by the invitation to deliver the Lionel Robbins lectures this year. I know the honor is not personal. I'm here as a representative of my discipline, and perhaps the invitation is a sign and a symbol of some developing dialogue between the discipline and some move towards greater unity in the social sciences. As is already quite obvious, I'm not an economist, and in the United States, very frequently before a plane takes off, they tell you that if you didn't know where we're going, then this is just about the right time to leave. So if you didn't know that I'm a psychologist, you may want to leave right now, because I will generally try, not always successfully, to stick to what I know, and what I know best is psychology and not economics. The little economics I know, I mostly have learned from a very close friend, Richard Thaler. But many economists consider Richard Thaler a heretic, and so they would doubt the quality of what I have learned from him. Almost everything else I know, certainly about decision theory and just about every bit of rigor that I can muster, I learned from my late colleague, Amos Tversky, who died in 1996. We worked together very closely for a period of about 15 years, which were certainly intellectually the happiest in my life, and had a profound influence on everything that I'm going to be saying here. I was going to tell you that if I make any mistakes, you should blame Richard Thaler for them. If I make any mistakes, do not blame Amos Tversky, because if he had been around, there would have been far fewer of them. He was a very harsh and tough critic and a perfectionist. And I wish he were here. as I was preparing these lectures, I was reminded of a technical report authored by the Swiss economist Bruno Frey, which Amos Tversky and I read together probably around 1974, 1975. Frey's paper discussed the psychological assumption of economics and the possibility that psychological research might be relevant to the discussion of these assumptions. And that piece, which I think was never published actually, it was bound as a technical report, it made such a deep impression on me that I remember the color of the binding, it was red. And I also remember almost literally a sentence in the first paragraph. And the sentence said, economic theory makes three assumptions about the economic agent. He is rational, he is selfish, and his tastes do not change. And what I remember as most astonishing about that particular statement was not the content, which I found, of course, outrageous, but the very small number of assumptions. This is not the way that psychologists work. Psychologists work with lists, and our lists are long. And at some stage, I was preparing to show you my list in the third lecture. I think the list got so long that a close friend who was looking at it told me that it would be completely ridiculous, and so you may not get to see my list. But in the course of these lectures, I will have something to say about the three items in Bruno Frey's set of assumptions. I'll be talking about two concepts of rationality. And you know, just about every author who thinks about rationality makes up a list of definitions of rationality, and I'm not going to make an exception here, except my list is quite short. I'll be talking about logical rationality and about substantive rationality. And by logical rationality, I mean the standard concept of rationality in economic theory, the idea of what is the rational agent. And here are some characteristics of this. The criterion for rationality is internal coherence or consistency, and that's been established for a long time, and in Lord Robbins' book on the foundations of economic science, he discusses rationality as consistency. But it's become actually much more rigid, I think, the criterion of consistency than it was in his writing. The idea is that people are endowed with a belief system and with a preference order. And the belief system is updated in particular ways, a Bayesian way, and the preference order is comprehensive. And if there is such a preference order, then people are said to maximize utility. The kind of utility that they maximize, I will distinguish from another kind of utility, and I will call it decision utility, because this is a utility that is inferred from choices and which in turn is used to explain choices. The systems of beliefs and preferences that people are endowed with are supposed to be inclusive. That is, we have almost, it might be said, a single preference about everything and a single belief about everything. And it is this inclusiveness which means both that it is comprehensive and fully articulated that permits or provides the internal coherence of the system. In general, the belief system and the preference order are regulated by axioms. So we have axiomatic theories of belief and of preference. We have expected utility theory and so on. But then there are some core assumptions which are almost built into the primitives of the theory. They're barely discussed as such. Inclusiveness is one of them. You may read textbooks, introductions to the standard view of rationality, and you may not encounter that notion of inclusiveness. Another notion that you may not encounter is, to use a term that Kenneth Arrow has introduced, extensionality. And this is the idea that the beliefs and the preferences really refer to states of the world. They do not refer to descriptions, but they have an objective reference. So if it's the same state of the world that is referred to by two descriptions, then we have the same beliefs about it, and we have the same preferences about it. This has had a variety of names. Amos Tversky and I called a variant of that invariance, and it's also known as consequentialism. In general, this notion of logical rationality is associated with the idea, with a model that people frequently use, that there is a pre-existing system of beliefs and of preferences, and that when people look up a decision or wish to make a decision or wish to see what they think about a problem, they can just look it up because it is in their system of beliefs. Substantive rationality is a very different concept. And substantive rationality, the criterion for substantive rationality, would be accuracy or success, not internal coherence. In the logical system, really correspondence with the world or the correspondence with the individual's own interest is never an issue. Everyone is entitled within the standard system. Everyone is entitled to his or her own opinions and to his or her own choices. So there is an expression of a liberal tradition or libertarian tradition in the logical, in the notion of logical rationality. In the notion of substantive rationality, we will allow ourselves to question the correspondence of people's beliefs to reality and the correspondence of their choices to their values and to their interests. And the kind of utility that we'll be looking at is a different kind of utility, much closer actually to Bentham's notion of utility, and Bentham defined utility as pleasure and pain. And I will call this experience utility to distinguish it from the decision utility that we infer from choices we use. Let me, in about a minute, tell you something about the history of challenges to the rationality assumption, and the challenges are to the prevailing view of rationality, which is the logical view. And the history, I think, can be divided fairly into the following phases. There was an early phase, shortly after the war, where expected utility theory, which was the dominant view in, that expressed the rationality model, the model of the rational agent, was challenged by some very important paradoxes. So Maurice Allais had his paradox, his paradox, and Daniel Ellsberg had his, and there continues to be a considerable amount of interest in paradoxes of utility theory. Later, these paradoxes actually are associated, they raise questions about the axioms of the theory and about whether the axioms make sense, and they in fact raise some questions about whether the axioms are normatively appropriate, that is, whether indeed every one of the axioms that were laid out, say by von Neumann Morgenstern, is necessary or is a necessary part of the definition of rationality. Amos Tversky and I think, can be credited for raising a different kind of challenge to the rationality assumption, where what we challenged more directly was the notion of coherence and with the notion of extensionality. And the question that we raised, and will be exposed to a number of these demonstrations today, had to do with whether people are capable of being consistent. That is, whether extensionality, which is an essential, though frequently unmentioned aspect of rationality, is in fact possible. Currently, I'm more interested in a new set of challenges to rationality, and I'm interested really in a question of whether substantive rationality is feasible. That is, what are the major obstacles to people working or making choices that maximize their own interest and that serve their values. And so we'll be talking today, and in the course of these lectures actually, we'll be talking about both kinds of rationality and challenges to both. The overview, and I will not go into detail on that, I'll talk separately about why logical rationality may not be feasible, and I'll talk about some obstacles to substantive rationality. I will not be talking about all of this today, but for those of you who come to hear me again in the course of the three lectures, I will mention just about everything on this outline, and I'll show you that overview later in the lecture. Let me move on and give you some examples of why Tversky and I concluded that extensionality is actually an extraordinarily demanding criterion and one which the human mind is very unlikely to be able to satisfy. And I will give you three examples. One, of non-extensional reasoning. And the story here is that Imastvursky was invited to give a talk at an international conference of forecasters, and he decided to run an experiment in line with some research that he and I were doing at the time. And so he administered a questionnaire to his audience, and there were two versions of the questionnaire. And this is, in the jargon of psychologists, known as a between-subject experiment, and this is quite an important part of the story that I'm going to tell you. So half of the people got asked, what is the probability of the following event? A massive flood in North America, sometime in the next decade, in which more than 1,000 people drown. So this is one event, and so half of the people are estimating the probability of this event. The other people in the audience are asked to assess the probability of the following event. An earthquake in California, sometime in the next decade, causing a flood in which more than 1,000 people drown. Now, you probably have seen the punchline. If you follow your intuitions, very likely, if you are like the rest of the audience and like most other people, you would judge the second event as more probable than the first. And indeed, there is quite a substantial difference. The higher probability is assigned to the second event than to the first. Now, this is absurd in some sense, and it is absurd, of course, because the second event is a proper subset of the first. I mean, it's in California and not anywhere in the United States. It's a flood that is caused in a particular way by an earthquake causing a flood, presumably a dam breaking. So it's a very small subset of the event described in the first problem. What then is actually happening? Well, we have a rule of probability, a basic rule of extensional reasoning, which is the inclusion rule. The probability of a more inclusive event can only be higher than the probability of a subset of it. This is a rule that people who are trained in logic and people who understand such matters are able to obey in what we call a within-subject experiment. That is, if you were shown both of these problems and given a fair amount of time to reason about them, you would detect that the second event is included in the first. And if you know anything about probability, you would conclude that the probability of the second must be smaller than the probability of the first. But all of that is a within-subject experiment. Now, when philosophers and other people who ply that sort of trade look for rules of logic, they are running a within-subject experiment. They are thinking of rules and they are thinking of examples. And then the inclusion rule seems self-evident. Most of the time, however, life is a between-subjects experiment. We encounter problems one at a time. When we encounter a problem, and when we are asked to assess a probability, like in one of those events, there is really no way, in the way that people normally think about probabilities, to ascertain or to ensure that when the probability of this event, of one event, is not lower than the probability of one of its subsets, is not lower than the probability of an event that includes it, or is not, I think you get the general idea of what I'm trying to say, so I won't, I'm bound to mess it up if I proceed. But the point of this example then is fairly simple. We do not look up probabilities from a fully articulated system of probabilities for events that respect their logical structure. We compute probabilities on the fly. We compute the probability given the data that we have or the thought that the questioner raises, arises in us. And given this, we are very unlikely to be able to obey the rules, although the rules are completely compelling in the within-subject structure. Let me give you another example, this one from work that Tversky and I did together. The story is that there is an epidemic is threatening, and we have some data about the epidemic. The example is actually quite artificial, but I think it makes a useful point. So we're told that if nothing is done, 600 people will die from that epidemic. This is the best estimate. And now, again, different groups of subjects are going to see this frame in different ways. They're going to see different versions of the problem. Here is one version. There are two programs that have been proposed to deal with that threatened epidemic. If program A is adopted, then 200 people will be saved. If program B is adopted, there is a one-third probability that 600 people will be saved and two-third probability that no people will be saved. So this is one version. In that version, there is a very substantial preference, which is called risk averse, for A over B. Here is another version of the same problem. In the other version, if program C is adopted, 400 people will die. If program D is adopted, there is one-third probability that nobody will die, and a two-third probability that 600 people will die. Now, you may recognize that this is what is technically known as a framing problem, in that the outcomes are objectively identical. The extensionally, the outcomes are the program A corresponds to C and B corresponds to D. What does change is the preference. Whereas in the first version of the problem, most people are risk averse, in the second version of the problem, most people are risk seeking. What seems to be happening is that the idea of 400 people dying for sure is very aversive and tends to make the other alternative more appealing. Again, when we see both problems, we can see that they're identical. When we see the problems one at a time, they raise different considerations and evoke different preferences. And this seems to be the way the mind works, so that avoiding that type of framing effect seems extremely difficult, if not altogether impossible. There is another remark that I'd like to make about this particular problem. And this is that once people are confronted, and I urge you to think about it, you know, if you want to think about this altogether, it's a good problem to think on. Once people are confronted with the fact that their intuitions about these two problems are internally inconsistent, that is, they wish to be risk-averse in one version, they wish to be risk-seeking in the other version, and now they're asked, please resolve the inconsistency. It turns out, this is certainly what happened to me with that problem, that I have no intuitions left. That is, I have intuitions about each version of the problem, but I really have no intuitions to appeal to when I'm considering both versions at once. And this is not uncommon. Let me give you another example, actually my favorite example of a framing effect, which is a policy-relevant problem due to Tom Schelling. Tom Schelling describes teaching in a public policy school and asking his students, there is in the United States, I suppose there is the same in Britain, there is an exemption on the income tax form for people and for families that have children. And so for every child, there is an exemption. So you compute the tax, and then you deduct from the tax, you deduct exemption. And Schelling raises the provocative proposition, do you think that the rich should have a larger tax exemption than the poor? And his class, up in arms, even in the United States, they're up in arms, and they think, of course not. You would not want the rich to enjoy a larger tax exemption than the poor. Now Schelling goes through the following exercise. Try to imagine a tax table. And so you have income, that would be on rows, and you have family size, that would be on columns. And the model family is a family with two children. So we could, without changing the tax at all, we could just rewrite the tax table so that the normal tax would be the tax paid by a family with two children. A family with more than two children will have exemptions, and a family with fewer than two children would pay a surcharge. And now Tom Schelling asks his student, do you think that a poor childless family should pay as large a tax surcharge as a rich childless family? And again, his students are up in arms, because they certainly do not think that the poor should be penalized just as the rich are for having no children. But now, if you consider both of these problems, both of these questions, they are the same question. The difference between the amount of tax paid by a childless family and by a family with two children can be labeled in two ways. It can be labeled as a surcharge to the childless family. It can be labeled as an exemption to the family with two children. Once that difference is labeled, it arouses powerful moral intuitions. The intuitions, as it happens, are internally inconsistent. When you recognize the inconsistency, as in the life problem, there are no intuitions left. People do not have very easily intuitions about the amount of tax that families should pay that have different number of children. People do have moral intuitions about exemptions and about surcharges, and those intuitions turn out not to be consistent. So what I've been trying to demonstrate through these examples is that achieving internal coherence or achieving internal consistency is extremely difficult for a limited mind. That is, we label, we do not think extensionally. We have intuitions about descriptions, not about states of the world. If we had intuitions about states of the world, then different descriptions of the state of the same state of the world would eventually elicit the same preferences and the same beliefs. In the example that I have given you, it is very clear that this is not the way the mind works, that we have intuitions about descriptions of the world, and because any state of affair can be described in multiple ways, we are very likely to end up with intuitions that are quite inconsistent. Now let me talk about another framing effect, which I think is a very important part of the history of decision analysis, certainly decision theory, and possibly even of economic thinking. In one of the all-time classics, I think, of the best essays ever written, possibly, there is an essay by Daniel Bernoulli, published in 1738 in the Academy, I think, of the Journal of the Academy of St. Petersburg, where Daniel Bernoulli invented expected utility theory. And the question that he put was, he discussed a merchant who has part or all, I think, of a ship loaded with spice. The ship is about to take off to go from Amsterdam to St. Petersburg at a time of the year where there is a 5% chance that the shipment will be lost. And the question is, should the merchant buy insurance? And who should sell the insurance to that merchant if he decides to buy it? There was no question of he or she at that time. Now, Bernoulli goes through a fascinating exercise where he discovers the notion of the utility of wealth. And the basic intuitions that he invokes is that there is a difference between the rich and the poor in how much they value money. Theme that, by the way, appeared quite saliently in Lord Robin's writings. The idea is that Bernoulli proposes is that the sensitivity is inversely the sensitivity to gains and losses of money is inversely proportional to wealth. And so I think he has the statement that a loss of 10 ducats for somebody who owns 100 is the same as the loss of one ducat for someone who owns 10. And so that's the basic intuition. Now it turns out, you go through the mathematics, and it's very easy now for high school, for Bernoulli it was more elaborate, you end up with a solution, which is that the utility of wealth must be a logarithmic function. That's the function that will give you this type of relationship. And then he derives the formula that is familiar, I'm sure, to all of us here who know anything about economics or decision theory, that you're supposed to be maximizing the expected utility rather than the expected value of the outcome, where the utility is the utility of the states of wealth that can be reached once the uncertainty is resolved. So that from the point of view of the merchant, the relevant states of wealth are the merchant's wealth, my wealth, say, if the ship gets there, my wealth if the ship doesn't get there, my wealth if I pay insurance and the ship is lost, and so on. What is utterly fascinating in that story, looking at it, you know, from 250 years later, is that in this formulation, which clearly derived from an intuition about the psychological response to gains and losses, there are no gains and losses. That is, the formulation is about final states of wealth. The intuition somehow has been swept into that formulation, the logarithmic formulation. Gains and losses nowhere appear. Now it turns out that this particular view of what the carriers of utility are, that decisions are made in terms of the utility of wealth, has been the dominant view of how people make financial decisions, and has certainly been the dominant view of people of how people should make financial decisions, so far as I know, ever since Bernoulli. So this begins something that is truly quite important. It's almost universal in analyses of risks and of financial decisions. I mean, it's just assumed that when you analyze, when you do an economic analysis of decision making under risk, you do it in terms of the states of wealth, the utility of the states of wealth that will be achieved once the uncertainty is resolved. The same idea is present in the indifference maps. The notion, when you look at an indifference map, there is something that's missing. The indifference map is about final states. It's about the endowments, how much of this you have, how much of that you have. There is one thing that is not represented, either in the theory of risk or in the indifference map, and this is where you are. Current wealth is not present in Bernoulli's formulation. Current wealth is not indicated in the standard representation of indifference map. The Coase theorem, which says that the final entitlements are independent of initial entitlements unless there are transaction costs. Again, we have the same feature, that the initial state doesn't matter. Everything is determined by the final state. Now, this, it turns out, is probably very appealing as a normative rule of rationality, but it's unlikely to be the way that people think. Suppose, let's try this. Suppose your wealth is 100,000 pounds, and consider whether you would accept the gamble in which, on the toss of a coin, you would lose 1,000 points with probability 0.5, or you would gain 1,500 pounds with probability 0.5. Now suppose your wealth is 100,000 pounds. Would you accept the gamble in which, after the toss of a coin or a ship getting to St. Petersburg or not getting there, your wealth would be 99,000 pounds with probability 0.5 or 101,500 pounds with probability 0.5? And now I'm just appealing to your intuitions. Do you think you would necessarily make the same choices in those two formulations of the problem? And I think it must be self-obvious, self-evident that most people would not, and that people are much more likely to be risk-averse in the first formulation and much closer to being risk-neutral in the second. So what Bernoulli offered to us was a particular way of framing financial decisions. And if financial decisions are framed differently, if they are framed in terms of gains and losses and not in terms of final weights, then we might end up with different preferences. So there are a couple of observations that, where, again, I'm mainly appealing to your intuitions because I will not have time to present a lot of data, but I think the conclusions are well-founded here. People who are given a problem in terms of gains and losses do not spontaneously transform it into wealth. That is, you do not add your wealth and look at the problem in terms of final states of wealth. The intuitive representation of choice problem is in terms of gains and losses. And quite frequently, when people are given a problem in terms of wealth, they might spontaneously, to simplify things, turn it into gains and losses, because this is the way that we commonly think. So there is something else that I'd like to point out, which is that the intuitions that people have about gains and losses, that is, how to respond to risky problems or risky propositions, formulated in gains and losses, seem to be fairly stable at different states of wealth. so that when you ask people, they don't know how wealthy they are, and if they were a little wealthier or a little less wealthy, they would very likely, or even a lot wealthier or a lot less wealthy, the responses tend to be very stable, and there is a fair amount of evidence for that. So the conclusion I'd like to reach is that wealth decision and what I'll call gains-loss decision are two separate frames for the financial problem. They are separate, they're incompatible, and Bernoulli chose one frame, and there is a lot to be said for the frame that Bernoulli chose. It is more inclusive than the gain-loss frame, and it has, I think, a greater claim to rationality. It has one problem. It is very bad psychology. That is, in general, the dominant frame in people's thinking is not going to be the wealth frame. It is much more likely to be the gain-loss frame. Let me, there is a theorem very recently proved by Matthew Rabin that I find quite surprising in a way, because it shows something that should have been evident a very long time ago. And this is that the formulation that people make decisions in terms of final wealth is just completely incapable of accounting for people's actual preferences. And I will not go through the proof, but what Matthew Rabin proves is from concavity alone. So he looks at a utility function for wealth that is concave. And then he looks at implications of the following kind. What happens? Suppose that if your wealth is 50,000 pounds, you would reject a gamble which with equal probability would lose 100 pounds or win 105. So we look at that gamble. Very few people like this gamble. So this gamble is completely unattractive. Notice, however, that if at that level of wealth you are that sensitive to risk, your function must be extraordinarily concave. Now, what he can derive is he can derive what your preferences would be if your wealth were less than 50,000. So if your wealth were 40,000, what your preferences would be. And then it turns out that you would reject the gamble. Actually, it's not 1,000, it's 100 pounds or 5.5 million pounds. So where you would not accept a gamble where you have equal chances to lose 100 pounds, pretty sure it's 100 pounds, or win 5.5 million. Now this is absurd, but notice what is happening. If we are that sensitive at this level between 100 and 105 pounds, and the difference between 50,000 and 40,000 is 100 times that. So you are going to end up with extraordinary concavity and with choices that make no sense whatsoever. So the conclusion is very clear, I think. The decisions that people make on small stakes are not governed, contrary to what Bernoulli assumed, are not governed by their preferences for gains and losses. Let me very quickly tell you something about people's preferences for gambles formulated in terms of gains and losses and not in terms of wealth. I misspoke earlier. I think I said that people do not make decisions in terms of wealth, not in terms of gains and losses. Let me tell you a few things that we know about people's preferences on risky propositions formulated in terms of gains and losses, not in terms of wealth, what I would call the normal formulation. And here I'll draw heavily on work that Tversky and I did, that we call prospect theory, that we published in 1979, and cumulative prospect theory that we published in 1992. We have several findings that are routine and that everyone is quite familiar with. We know that people are risk averse for gains, moderate or high probability. We know that lotteries are attractive. We know that insurance is attractive. And we know that sure things are overweighted relative to probable things. And that, you know, is a direct consequence, basically, from the LA paradox. There are three other facts about decision-making with gains and losses that I think are worth paying attention to. And those three are less well known. One is there is a vast amount of risk seeking when people are faced with aversive choices. In fact, there is just about as much risk seeking in the negative domain as there is risk aversion in the positive domain. You can consult your intuitions. If you were confronted with a choice between a 90% chance to lose 1,000 pounds and losing 850 pounds for sure, and in a normal group of people, non-professional, you would get up to 80% of people preferring the gamble to the sure loss. The sure loss is extremely aversive. In the same way that if you flip that problem into the domain of gain, you would get a similar preference for the risk averse choice. There is another feature of gains-loss choices that is worth noting. I call it near proportionality. If you take a gamble, for example, you look at your cash equivalent for an offer in which you have a 50% chance to win 100 pounds. In a group of non-professionals, that would end up to be somewhere between 35 and 40 pounds. You now ask the same question for a 50-50 chance to win 1,000 pounds or nothing. And the cash equivalent goes up not by a factor of 10, but by a factor of well over 9. You then multiply it again by 10, and again, the cash equivalent increases almost proportionately. There is one utility or value function that will do this. It's a power function. And Tversky and I chose to represent the utility of gains and of losses by a power function. And then there is something that I think is the most important thing that I'll be talking about today in substantive terms. There is extreme risk aversion for mixed gambling. That is, if we present people with a prospect in which we're going to toss a coin, you have to put up a stake. Say your stake would be, say, 100 pounds. If the coin shows, well, American terms, tails, you lose your stake. You lose the 100 pounds. If the coin shows heads, you win X. What would X have to be for you to accept this gamble? And here we have a very reliable and highly repeatable result. The median in a group of any substantial size, that again, barring, you know, professional gamblers and investors, but non-professionals looking at this, it's somewhere between 200 and 250 pounds is going to be the median. And that is a very extreme level of risk aversion. When we were thinking about this, we were reminded of a remark that Mark Twain made about his wife's attitude to his gambling. And Mark Twain commented that his wife doesn't mind his gambling. She minds his losing. And we call that loss aversion. The phenomenon that we have here is a phenomenon of a major aversion to losses, a very asymmetric treatment of losses and of gains. So, the value function that we are talking about looks about like this. It's S-shaped, it's concave in the domain of gains, it's convex in the domain of losses to explain the various phenomena I've talked about, and it's substantially steeper in the domain of losses than in the domain of gains, and indeed by a factor of 2 or 2.5 to accommodate a lot of the results. So that's a picture, very crude picture. There is much more to prospect theory than I've said in these few minutes. But it's a crude picture of what decision making for gains and losses with risky prospects is, and other major findings that we have, and of a possible theory to account for them. I'd like now to raise a question about the rationality of loss aversion. Is loss aversion on small stakes rational? And to expose another aspect of the difficulty of being rational. Paul Samuelson has a well-known article in which he discusses the folly of a friend of his. And Samuelson offered his friend, I don't know if really or just in jest, a gamble, where on the toss of a coin, the friend would either lose $100 or win $100 with equal probability. And the friend turned, Samuelson's friend, who is an economist, by the way, turned down that gamble. And Samuelson quotes the friend and he says, who says, I would be much more sensitive to the loss of £100 than to the pleasure of winning 200, so I do not find that proposition attractive. Now, Samuelson went on, and the friend then adds, but if you offered me 10 of those gambles, I would take them. And Samuelson thought that this is deeply wrong, and he went on to prove a theorem that if you would reject a gamble in any of the possible outcomes, that if, let's put it this way, if in any of the possible states of wealth that could arise while playing 10 of these gambles, you would reject one of the gambles, you should never accept the 10. This is basically Samuelson's argument. One never should argue with Paul Samuelson, certainly not in his presence, but even when he's not there, because the risk of being wrong is high. But I think Samuelson missed a point that's very important about that example. The friend was indeed making a mistake, but I do not think that the mistake was the one that Samuelson had in mind. The friend was making a mistake of accepting that frame and of looking at the decision to play that gamble as if it stood on its own. That is incoherent. This is the kind of gambles being, you know, looking at a gamble as if you are not going to play again. That doesn't make any sense. This might make sense on a deathbed. It doesn't make any sense for somebody who expects to live. The very frame of a decision as a single decision, a single play, is in some sense not coherent. There are going to be more opportunities, perhaps not exactly this game, but then other games. You'll have more opportunities to play, not with a coin, in other ways. But because there are going to be all of these opportunities, you should in fact adopt the frame of looking and adopting a policy for a set of decisions and not making a decision of having a preference for a decision on its own. It turns out that if you use the, this is very clear, by the way, this rule, if you allow yourself to think that you are going to be playing again when you are shown a single play, then you become risk neutral very, very quickly. The same value function that I showed you earlier that generates that remarkable amount of loss aversion on one play, on six plays, makes you virtually risk neutral. And so the question of rationality here is it acceptable and is it coherent to treat decisions on their own, to accept the frame as it is put to you that you are to make this decision now? Or does rationality in fact demand a broader view where we think in terms of repeated play? So what I'd like to say is the risk aversion exhibited by Samuelson's friend is substantively absurd. It is very costly to be that risk averse because in fact there is repeated play in life. And I would also like to make an observation about logical rationality in this context. Logical rationality, I believe, is impossibly demanding. This is the main argument of this lecture. The human mind is limited and bounded, and we cannot satisfy the requirements of logical rationality. Logical rationality, as it is implemented in decision theory and in a lot of economic thinking, is also much too permissive. It permits, it allows people to make choices that in a real sense are absurd. That is, Samuelson accepts that it is all right for his friend to turn down that extremely advantageous gamble. This, I think, is wrong. Now, why are we so risk-averse? And if we are so loss-averse, why do we take risks at all? And this is a story that I'm not going to mention to develop, but I do want to mention. It turns out that the reason that people are both loss-averse and quite frequently risk-taking is that they're absurdly optimistic as well, and so they deny the risk that they are taking, and this is how they end up taking risks. But this is a story I will not tell you much about. I have very little more to say, but I would like to say a few things about loss aversion. Loss aversion, in my view, is the most important notion that has come out of certainly anything that I've been associated with in the study of decision making. It has implications for decision under risk, for decision not under risk, for moral preferences, for the arrangement of society, for what people are willing to trade on, and so on. Let me say a few things about it. The psychological principles that are relevant to the framing of decision-making as I'm describing is a very general psychological idea, which is that people are sensitive to changes and not to states. And this is true in general of our perceptual system is designed to pick up changes and differences and not to be extremely sensitive to sustained states. So changes are used, and this is a theme that will be developed in subsequent lectures, changes are used as proxies for the evaluation of states. So we take a change from one state to another, and this is how we evaluate the state that we're going to. Tversky and I used to think of loss aversion as expressing the priority of pain over pleasure. And there is an asymmetry in the response or in the relative urgency of pain and pleasure. I'm no longer so sure. I'm not absolutely sure that this is where loss aversion comes from. It could come as a very general conservatism in decision making. But whatever it is an extraordinarily potent force in human affairs. When does loss aversion come into play? Well, the question is, when are losses experienced? And it turns out that people have some control over when they will experience losses, and that this has an effect on their behavior. One of my former students, now a professor of finance, Terry O'Dean, has done a study of 10,000 investors who control their own investment accounts. And he has complete information about what they hold, what they sell, what they buy, and what happens to the stock they sell and buy. And he looks at investors who hold stocks that he calls winners and stocks that he calls losers. Winners are stocks that are now currently selling at a higher price than the price at which they were purchased. Losers are stocks that are selling at a lower price than the purchase price. And the question that O'Dean asks is, are people neutral in their decisions about which stock to sell? Turns out they're not at all. A winner is twice as likely to be sold as a loser. People hang on to their losers. And they seem to hang on to their losers in order not to realize the loss, because once you lose it, then you have lost. Until you're keeping it, there is hope. And that kind of hope turns out to have very substantial implications for decision making. There is an equity premium puzzle. Over the last 70 years, nobody guarantees that this will go on like that, but stocks have returned approximately 7% a year more than safer, less risky investments. And that's a puzzle. And, people have been aware that normal notions of risk aversion cannot explain this enormous gap. Benozzi and Thaler have proposed an account, which is an account in terms of loss aversion, which is that when people look to the future, the stock market can be viewed as a series of gambles. So, you know, you can look at each day there is a gamble. And then you have many gambles. So in a year you have 365 gambles. If you hold that stock, you are playing the same gamble 365 times. And if you have it for 10 years, it's 3,650 and so on. Now it turns out that the longer you hold a gamble, then the more predictable, in some sense, the relative returns are going to be. And so the riskiness diminishes, the volatility, if you will, diminishes relative volatility, not absolute volatility. Absolute volatility increases, but relative volatility diminishes as you hold the gamble over time. Now, what Benozzi and Thaler, the exercise they perform is to ask, what is the horizon at which, if people compute the gains and losses and compute their gamble for that horizon, bonds and stocks will be equally attractive? It turns out to be almost exactly 1 year. and which is psychologically plausible in many ways. That is, the idea is that people make an investment and they think of when they will evaluate it. And they do not think very long term, they do not think very short term, but there is an intermediate level at which they think. There are other demonstrations of loss aversion. There is just one that I want to talk about, one last one. We're now moving from risk to the riskless world, and this is going to be my last example. We're looking at somebody who is being offered, who has the opportunity to be in one of two positions. Position A, where he is more of good Y, or position D, where he or she has more of good X and less of good Y. Now, unlike the standard representation of indifference curves, here it's going to matter where the person is looking at this gamble. So you could be here, and you'd be asking yourself, do I give up good Y in order to get some X? Or you could be here, and you'd have to give up some X in order to get Y. Or you could be here, and you'd be asking yourself, which of these two do I want to get? Do I want to get more of X or more of Y? And here, which of these would I need to lose? The point of what I've been telling you is that if people think in terms of gains and losses, then the difference between state A and state C can be labeled in two different ways depending on where you look at it. If you look from A, you're going down, you're looking at a loss. If you look from C, you're going up, you're looking at a gain. And if people are loss averse, they're not going to evaluate the same difference in the same way. They're going to be much more sensitive going from A to C than going from C to A. Here's an experiment that demonstrates this. It's a study of what something that Dick Thaler called the endowment effect. We come to a room where we present people with, well, mugs, decorated university, you know, mugs with a crest on them. And everyone, well, we would allocate on an obviously random basis. Half of the people in the audience say, one-third of the people would get a mug, and it's obviously random. And two-thirds would not get a mug, and everybody would get a questionnaire. And now, if you have a mug, your questionnaire would tell you the mug is yours and you can keep it, and you can go home with it. However, you will also have an opportunity to exchange that mug for money. And now the question is, if we offer you $10, you want the mug or the money, $9.50, and so on, all the way down to 50 cents. So we're basically asking them, what is your selling price for the mug you have? If you're a buyer, you'd be told, look at your neighbor's mug. You could buy one just like it, and how much would you be willing to pay for that mug? And $10, and so on. If you're a chooser, you'd be told, look at your neighbor's mug. You could get a mug just like it, or you could get a sum of money. And if we offer you $10, you want the $10 or the mug, $9.50, and so on. What do we find? Well, we find the following pattern, and it's quite a robust pattern. This experiment has been replicated many times, including by people who did not believe in it, so that's the highest form of replication. It's a solid result. The sellers value the mug much more, about twice as much, as the buyers and the choosers in this experiment. Now, this has some significant implications. First, I'd like you to see that this is predicted by the analysis I was presented earlier. For the seller, the problem is, do I want to give up the mug? For the buyer or the chooser, the question is, do I want to get the mug? The issue, if we think in terms of gains and losses, is not having a mug or not having a mug. That's final states. The issue is getting a mug or giving up a mug. That's a gain or a loss. That's a change. And that's the difference between the sellers, the choosers, and the buyers. We're not imposing that frame on them. They adopt it. Now, it turns out that because of that difference, there is, when we open the market, we create a market, there is not all that much trade. There is half as much trade as standard economic theory would predict. This is not because of transaction costs for the economists here, because we can create exactly the same game, except that without mugs, people are talking about tokens for money, and you get the economic prediction working exactly. So there are no transaction costs. Explanation. What seems to be happening is there is a major status quo bias, that is, people stay where they are. And it turns out that Coase's theorem is disproved in this situation. That is, initial entitlements matter. The people who started out with mugs tend to end up with the mugs. The people who started up without tend to end up without them. I'd like to point something out about the sellers and the choosers. The sellers and the choosers are in objectively identical situations. They can go home with a mug or they can go home with money. The buyers are slightly poorer. But the sellers and the choosers are purely identical. This is a framing effect. That difference, the 2-to-1 difference, is a framing effect. So it's a failure of logic or rationality. It is also, I think, a failure of substantive rationality. The reason we ran those experiments with mugs is that I have a passion for coffee mugs. I get a lot of pleasure from the coffee mug. I wouldn't trade with my wife. She has her own, and I have mine, and so on. So coffee mugs are important in my life. I derive a lot of experience utility from it. It's also an object that you have for a long time. Now notice that if we were thinking of the stream of utility to be derived from that mug, what people are doing is completely absurd. But they're not thinking of the stream of utility associated with having or not having a mug. They're thinking of getting a mug or of giving one up. They're very myopic. They're responding to the emotions associated directly with the transaction of the moment. And in that sense, there is here, I believe, a failure of substantive rationality. So, what have I tried to tell you? I've tried to tell you that rationality is very difficult, at least as it is defined in the standard economic theory. It is an extremely difficult proposition. The mind is not built to achieve it. It demands inclusiveness, which we cannot do. It demands extensionality, which we cannot do. Substantive rationality demands thinking broadly, which we find very difficult. Financial rationality probably demands thinking in terms of states of final wealth, which we do not naturally do. So our inclination is not in the direction of being fully rational. And in that sense, the psychologist answered to a narrow definition of rationality. I do not want to be here and say people are irrational. I do not believe it for a moment. I'm saying economics, it seems to me, has adopted a definition of rationality which is impossibly demanding and overly permissive and is not suitable, I believe, to the human mind. And with that, I will close. Thank you.
Well, we do have time for a few questions if we have people who are willing and interested to ask them. And there's also a roving microphone somewhere, waved in the front, which can be used by anyone who wants to ask a question. Perhaps, Richard, do you want to ask the first question since you've got the gadget?
No, it's not working.
Switch it on the bottom normally. You just have to shout then.
You put up a graph of the utility in relation to income. It was a kink as opposed to a certain one. Are you saying that your research, provided you move that kink around to where the person is now, you find it a common function that can explain how it behaves?
The graph I presented was for the value of gains and losses, not a standard. It was not a utility for wealth. It was the value of gains and losses, and I should have dwelled, I should have left it a little longer. And that the general form of this seems to be quite robust to different levels of wealth. We have recently done studies with, over a wide range of levels of wealth, and you find quite similar coefficients of loss aversion. So you would eventually, very wealthy people are going to be closer to risk neutral when, it's not worth their time to even worry about the problem. But in general, the coefficient of loss aversion seems to be quite robust.
We've still got this risk-averse microphone. Doesn't want to turn itself on. That's it. It must be on now. It's making noises now.
1, 2?
Yeah.
You got it.
You got it, yeah. We got two microphones.
You've made a very persuasive case that left to ourselves, we're not coherent. Can we have coherence beaten into us, for example, by attending lectures of the type you've given us, or courses in decision theory, and is there anything in it for us to have coherence thus beaten into us?
I suppose the question you're asking me is whether decision analysis is worth pursuing. I'm not sure that we can have rationality beaten into us. I do not think there is a way of overcoming framing problems or of turning between subjects experiment that life presents us with into within subjects experiment that we can solve. The one recipe that we probably have is that people may be able to learn that there are to adopt some rules and also to recognize problems that are particularly important and particularly difficult for them, and in those problems to seek advice. And so it is possible to teach people, I think, to make financial decisions in terms of final wealth. Possible and probably very useful. So there are certain discrete things that we can teach people. This is not the same as beating rationality into them, which I think is probably quite impossible.
Your story is in terms of the way the mind works. Is there a complementary story involving social institutions that goes along with it?
I'm sure there is, but I have my hands full trying to understand the mind of an individual, and I have not... If you're alluding, as perhaps you are, to the possibility that the results that I was describing are culture-bound or in some ways derived from social factors, then you will find some resistance. I'm more inclined to think biologically in these terms and to take a reductionist position and say that a lot of what we see here expresses laws of perception and basic laws of cognitive functioning at the individual level, which are, I would expect, well, the evidence is weak, I would expect them to be universal. Beyond that, I shouldn't speak.
I'd just like to query your assumption that changes are proxies for states and ask whether people don't value change as a good in itself, whatever the first or second state. Now, I ask this because there's a good deal of research showing that people in countries with very different levels of living standards are equally happy, and what makes them happier is usually a change for the better in living standards. What makes them unhappier is a drop in living standards. For example, just to take a very crude example, Japanese, in terms of states, are very well off, but recently their national income has been falling or static. They're very unhappy. Chinese have about a 20th of the living standards of Japanese, but their living standards are going up very fast, and at least if you ignore the human rights aspect, they're probably happier. And I think Lionel Robbins would have put this by saying you can measure ordinal utility but not necessarily cardinal utility. In other words, it's being better off than somebody else or better off than you were before, which counts rather than trying to measure some absolute level of living standards.
Actually, this is the main topic of my talk tomorrow.
Sorry.
So I'm... but the... in saying that people use changes as proxies for states, what I meant in fact was that when people look at a sudden gain in income or at a change in their circumstances, like winning a lottery or becoming a paraplegic, an example that I'll be discussing at some length tomorrow, that people think primarily, so it seems, in terms of the transition from one state to another. And so they think that winning the lottery is absolutely marvelous and become a paraplegic is a horrible disaster. And in both cases, they exaggerate greatly because there is a great deal of adaptation going on, which eventually will bring the lottery winners down to earth and will make the paraplegics much less miserable than we normally think they are. And so in that sense, in our thinking, we do use intuitively the moment of change as a proxy for the state, and we intuitively, when we're thinking of transition from one state of wealth to the other, we're thinking in terms of the emotion associated with a gain rather than about the utility associated with the state. So I think we're in complete agreement.
And one final question, perhaps.
Maybe by coincidence, I was doing my food shopping this morning and I found myself making choices not on the basis of my final wealth, but on the basis of some intangible increments in my pleasure per unit spend. This suggests that many of my choices are multi-attributed, not simply states, final financial states. Do you have any evidence to suggest that I'm behaving rationally or irrationally in that situation?
The shopping is too complicated for me. I deal with simpler problems, made up, and which we have done very little with multi-attribute decisions. And I, so quite seriously, I think that the situation is much more complex in the shopping market than in the experiments that I have described. It turns out, however, that there are very important decisions that have the structure that I have described. And so within the classes situation that I've studied, which is a very small part of the world of decisions and is, you know, very crude problems and so on, we find some principles which I think are important in many ways. They are not the whole story of decision making. And I'm very glad that that was the last question, to end on a note, on a reasonable note of humility, because I have spoken very sweeping terms, and it was good. Thank you, Larry.
Well, let's not end with too much humility, because I'd like to urge everyone to come to the next two lectures, for which Professor Kahn has provided such a good trailer, and thank him very much for having initiated the series so well tonight. Thanks very much.
Thank you.